Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist, 27th of April. A cure for aging is the major thing. And I'll try and read through it in one episode. How's that? So the last one was Memories of Oppenheimer. And I'm just going to read through the editorial. Climate is an emergency. Forcing meaningful action shouldn't be left up to just a few people. Last week, Waterloo Bridge near New Scientist's London office was transformed from its usual melee of buses, lorries, bicycles and cars into a green oasis filled with plant pots, food stalls, bongo playing, sit-in protesters and briefly a skateboard park. It's easy to disparage the idealism and the otherworldliness that characterised the Extinction Rebellion protests in London, pictured and elsewhere, or to decry the less peaceful aspects of the destruction it caused to the ordinary people's lives. But guess what? They are all ordinary people. As revered naturalist David Attenborough was pointing out simultaneously on British TV screens, the times we are living in are less so. Climate change is real. Climate change demands action from all our states. It is tempting to modulate the action through the prism of pre-existing beliefs of right versus left, the individual versus collective, the market versus state. But climate change is emphatically not a political issue. I would thoroughly agree with it. And you have to realise that your spectrum or your tools operate not only on what you wish, but they also operate back on you. That's my view. See it as a moral one, if you like. Our duty, knowing what we do, to leave the world in which future generations can thrive as we have. Or if that isn't your bag, think in terms of economic self-interest. Invest now and rewards later. It shouldn't be left up to a few activists to attempt to force meaningful climate action. We must all exert pressure with our votes and our voices. Many countries, including the UK, face tough climate decisions. Australia is due to vote next month in the federal elections where the climate issues are a key battleground, see page 15. The goal should be net zero emissions as fast as possible. How fast is feasible and legitimate matter for debate? But the goal itself is not. If we elect politicians to lead, politicians of all stripes, listen to science and do your job. The age of anti-aging. History is littered with courses of people who claim to have found the fountains of youth. That beautiful. So caution is warranted claims to the imminent arrival of drugs to slow aging. But the field of anti-aging medicine is now a serious one. A decade ago, you could go to conferences and hear outlandish predictions about people living to 150 years old or more, often accompanied by the rolling eyes of many scientists in the room. You could hear the rolling eyes, apparently. Now the emphasis is no longer on radical life extension, but ensuring we stay healthier for longer if it translates into verified drugs that could presage a medical, economic, and social revolution. You can imagine that. If you would then, therefore, I mean, the population, the population increased, but the actual impulse, you'd be able to train someone up for 10 years to last, well, at the moment, it's 10, 20 years of productive, 20 years semi-productive work. Now, if it's 10 years and 50 years productive work, it'd be amazing. Although automation and all that stuff, I'm trying to think through it. Now, if this runs keeping at bay the age-related conditions that are the leading cause of mortality in the developed world, will be a humanitarian triumph on par with the sanitation or vaccines. Of course, there are possible downsides. For example, if larger numbers of slightly older people refuse to budge from their jobs or homes covered by younger folk, but such problems are fixable. Well, there you go. They're fixable. Wouldn't we rather that than a world in which nursing homes are the only way out? I suppose that's the major thing. SpaceX capsule failure. A capsule that was meant to allow the US to launch its own astronauts to space again appears to have exploded. I've been bitten to death by mosquitoes. To exploded during a test to be carried out on the ground on the 20th of April. SpaceX, which is developing the Crew Dragon capsule, pictured left, has so far acknowledged that only anomaly occurred. However, a huge clouds of smoke were photographed billowing from the test sites in the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, and the video posted on Twitter seems to show the capsule exploding. The US has had to rely on the Russia to get people into space since the shuttle was retired in 2011. SpaceX was leading the race to develop a private alternative. Crew Dragon is designed to carry up to 7 astronauts to space and return to Earth. The same capsule that apparently exploded carries supplies dummy Ripley to the International Space Station in a flawless March flight test. In the event of a problem with the Falcon 9 rocket that launches it, the Crew Dragon capsule is meant to able fire its rockets and fly away to safety. SpaceX has been planning to test this in-flight abort system in the coming months, prior to the first crewed flights this sometime this year. SpaceX and rival Boeing were originally meant to start sending astronauts to space in 2017. Further delays look likely, but it remains to be seen how big a setback this is for SpaceX. NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine said that it had been notified of the anomaly and will work with SpaceX to move forward. Faulty phones break when tested. Quote, quite simply, there has never been a device like the Galaxy Fold, said Samsung, unveiling the phone with a folding screen earlier this year. It is unlikely that the world's biggest phone maker had in mind pre-release publicity, which reviewers said they accidentally broke the device. Several people given early access to the phone reported busts in the screen after a day's use. Some mistakenly peeled off what appeared to be a screen protector, but was, in fact, an integral part of the hardware. The device's main feature is that it opens out like a phone, from a phone size to reveal a tablet-sized screen. Now, just days before the device was due to go to the US, hi, Ceci, the cleaners are inside. Samsung had to delay the release and is just sure the new launch date. Samsung says the problems could be related to the hinge or the device and will take measures to strengthen display protection. Chinese accelerator firm Huawei and Xiaomi have folding phones in the works. Oh dear, they would, wouldn't they? Fruit bananas fuels Kakobo baby boom. So Kakobo is a little flightless night parrot. Yeah, it's something of a legend in Australia, but it actually exists in New Zealand. There is a new hope for the world's most largest parrot. The critically endangered Kakobo pictured after a record number of chips hacks. Further than 150 Kakobo lived in New Zealand after the species was hit by hunting, pests and deforestation. I think presumably over a long time. But the enormous... But enormous effort to regrow the population is paying off, with almost 90 chips being expected to emerge before the bumper breeding season ends. Nocturnal flightless bird has a young only when the rimu tree is in full fruit, which happens every few years. Oh dear. An unusually abundant amount of fruit this year seems to have driven females to start breeding early and sometimes even nest again after the first brood has grown. It isn't all good news, the more than half a dozen chicks have already died, and several have had to be moved from their nests after signs of poor growth. All the chicks will be fitted with radio transmitters when they are about 2 months old, Andrew Digby, a New Zealand Department of Conservation, says on Twitter. UK targets the wildlife trade. The UK government has announced £4.6 billion in funding the projects of tracking illegal wildlife trade around the world. The project is part of a 6-year push to the UK that will spend more than a total of £36 million yes, in effort to fight trade. The newly announced projects include efforts to stop smuggling in Madagascar, to disrupt the grey parrot trade in Cameroon, and reduce the demand for marine turtle products from Nicaragua. Quote, the Illegal Wildlife Trade Challenge Fund is backing projects that will tackle criminals at the source in the countries that are destinations for the items made from illegally traded plants and animals. The UK Minister Therese Coffey said in a statement, the government is also drawing on expertise on changing behaviour to recommend the most effective approaches to reduce demand for illegal wildlife products, such as environmental education and marketing on social media. Oh dear. Okay, viral treatment for brain cancer. You're by Michael LePage. Genetically modified pathogens may be key to shrinking deadly tumors, and they show a not a virus. They show, oh yes, it is a bacteriophage landing. People with curable melanomas in the brain or breast cancers are to get injections of tumor-fighting viruses. The viruses will test the safety of a virus that has been engineered to shrink tumors, an approach that holds a promise for a range of cancers, including deadly brain tumors. The idea of using viruses to kill cancers goes back to more than a century, inspired by the anecdotal reports that some people with viral infections have been cured of malignancies. But turning viruses that can infect and kill human cells into safe and effective treatment that targets only a tumor has proved tricky. Researchers are making progress at last. In 2015, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved the first ever virus-based cancer treatment, a genetically modified herpes virus for advanced melanomas that can't be completely removed by surgery. Many other viruses treatments are in development. Amin Hajitu of the Imperial College of London and his colleagues have come up with an unusual form of viral treatment based on the phage, which is a mobile virus car. It builds itself, basically. It goes around and locks on things. These are I love phages. Phages are designed to bind to cancer cells and inject DNA into them, but these modified phages can't replicate. This means that they can't spread to healthy tissue. Oh dear. Unlike viruses that normally attack human tissues. Okay, well, that's off. Has seemed to develop this phage by giving it genetic instructions that enable it to bind to proteins that are often found outside the human cancer cells, and then inject the DNA into them. They also gave genes to code for toxic proteins. Once injected these genes, cancer cells begin to make the proteins and then die. Okay. So that's how they don't die due to explosion. They just die. They just inject toxin cells. In tests on dogs, the phage shrank tumours and, in some cases, made them completely disappear. Hutu says this phage has now set to begin the first stages of human trials like this year, so I do like this one. The trial will take place in Rutgers Cancer Institute in New Jersey and involve volunteers whose breast or brain melanoma cancers haven't responded to other treatments. Hutu is already working on a more advanced version of the phage treatment to target glioblastoma, a type of brain cancer with few treatment options. At the moment, around half the people diagnosed it die within 15 months. My God, that's not too good. Glioblastoma cells often resist cancer drug called TMZ by activating genes that block it. Nidra's team has taken the code from the genetic switch that fires up these genes and added it to the engineered phages, which mean that when infected tumor cells will try to use the genes to resist the drug, they will make even more of the toxic proteins. Oh dear, that's complicated, isn't it? Seek and destroy. When mice with human glioblastomas were given this phage and the team was said together, they survived for 2 months, whereas controls died after a month. The treated mice also lived longer than those given either phage or TMZ on its own. Human trials will still several years away, says Hajitu. The phage is promising for the brain cells in particular because after being injected into the bloodstream, it seeks out tumours around the body and can cross the blood-brain barrier. By contrast, most other experimental viral cancer treatments have to be injected directly into the tumours. Okay, the phage is good. It would be much easier to roll out a treatment that can be delivered by routine injections, says Alan Meek at the Institute of Cancer in London. The desired phage doesn't need to carry the genes for replicating itself, so more DNA can be engineered into up to 20,000 letters of code. This means that the scope for adding extra genes to enhance the effectiveness, and while further DNA edits could enable the phage to tackle other types of tumours. Interesting. Here's something interesting by Michael Marshall. Chemists developed green light fertilizers. There could finally be a way to make fertilizers without releasing huge parts of greenhouse gases. So the Haber process is a major thing, and it takes up 1% of the world's energy, but it's responsible for more than 90% of the nutritional value that we eat. Take that in. That's pretty amazing. Well, I think grass. Let's read what it says. If the new method works on an industrial scale, it could help with the world's growing population while limiting climate change a good deal. Farmers rely on fertilizers to feed their crops. Okay, feed the crops to feed us. Many of these contain ammonia, but only way to make it on large scale is the Haber-Bosch process. The method, which was developed in the 1900s, makes the chemical by combining hydrogen and oxygen from the air with hydrogen. The process requires temperatures around 425 degrees Celsius and presses up to 200 times normal atmospheric pressure. The energy required to achieve this typically comes from fossil fuels, and the ammonia industry accounts for about 1% of the annual greenhouse emissions. So, to solve this problem, Yoshiki Nishibashi, University of Tokyo, Japan, and his colleagues have developed a way of making ammonia that not only works at room temperature, but also at standard atmospheric pressure. Well, yes, I think you can make anything except the yield amount would be too good. The chemists have been searching for replacement of the Haber-Bosch process for years. Chemists have been. In 2003, a team converted nitrogen to ammonia using molybdenum-based catalysts to speed up the reaction. The first method without heat or pressure worked. Now that's an interesting aspect. Molybdenum has delocalized electrons, and nitrogen has got this entire, really interesting because it's got no electron affinity. In 2011, Nibashi's team succeeded in making ammonia from nitrogen using a catalyst based on molybdenum iodide, which worked at room temperature and standard pressure. Okay, I don't understand. However, this is still a major problem. As well as a catalyst, this method needed expensive chemicals to react with nitrogen to provide the protons for the reaction. This pushed up the cost and limited the usefulness of this to some other new methods. Nibashi's team has now found a way to use cheap, readily available substances instead. Researchers' chosen reagent is a strong reactive samarium dioxide. Diiodide. So samarium. That's interesting. Samarium is a rare earth. Their proton sources are either simple alcohols or water. When combined with molybdenum-based catalysts, the team was able to make a lot of ammonia rapidly. The ammonia production rate is 500 times faster than that of the Haber-Bosch process. This hurts me to hear. What does that mean? Sizenbashi is also one or two orders of magnitude faster than other reactions developed so far, and thus is approaching the speed of the enzyme nitrogenase, which is found in fungi, used to capture nitrogen from the air. Nishibashi, why don't you actually get fungi and stuff like that to do it? I don't understand. Nishibashi has patented the process and is working with Nissan Chemical Corporations on scaling the method up for the industrial productions. The sticking point will probably be the huge volumes of samarium that would be needed for a large-scale ammonia production, pushing up the costs. It may be possible to tweak how the samarium behaves to reduce the amount that is needed, but Arnold at the University of Edinburgh, UK, says it would be better to stick with the Haber-Bosch process, which has already been brilliantly optimized, and instead find out ways to cut out greenhouse gas emissions. It's sort of like the petrol engine. The petrol engine is just such a brilliantly optimized thing. The Haber process, they have really tweaked everything possible out of it. Yeah, that is, if you could run the Haber process out of solar energy or something like that, would be a better thing. Dingoes can keep Australia's, and the great thing is that it does have hot iron, but it hasn't got really amazing catalyst. Dingoes may keep Australia's feral cats down. Dingoes are no friend of Australia's sheep farmers, but they could play a pivotal role in suppressing the number of feral cats that devastate wildlife. Australia's non-native feral cats, I don't think we have native feral cats, have contributed to the extinction of 20 mammals. Well, surely... Oh, yeah, mammals. Mammals and placentals and stuff like that. And are common across the country, unlike dingoes. Relatively few dingoes live in Australia's south, east, west, kept out by the famous 560-kilometre dingo fence, which stretches from one end of Australia to the other. Between 2011 and 2017, Mark Lennick and his colleagues at the University of New South Wales visited sites on both sides of the fence. They collected cats and dingo feces, as well as information on sightings of both predators to estimate their population size. The team gathered data on the abundance of rabbits and dusky hoppy mice, which are common prey in the feral cats and dingo set. There's definitely a hopping mouse in Australia, and they look like mice, but they just hop. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. On the southeast side of the fence, dingoes were around 65 times less common than the northwest side. Prey species were almost 11 times more common, and cats were 5 times more common. Cats are in the frame. As expected, cat populations on the southeast side of the fence rose and fell in line with the abundance of prey. But on the opposite side, the dingoes were more common, something different happened. There was a decline in prey in 2013, and the number of cats never recovered, even as prey numbers increased again. In other words, it appears dingoes can sometimes help keep cats' numbers down. However, Jenjen Allen, University of Southern Queensland, is sceptical. In an experiment that tracked the effects on dingoes culling at the 9 sites across Australia over many years, Allen and his colleagues found that no change in the cat population or to the health of wildlife. I find it difficult to put my faith in correlations when manipulative experiments have been shown otherwise, he says. That's quite good. Amazing. So simple. Huge dinosaurs may have stood on tiptoes. It's an Australian dinosaur. Examining fossils have revealed that 22-ton dinosaur was able to flatten its feet to the ground. It was unable to. Instead, it may have stood on tiptoes, like elephants. Elephants are on tiptoes. And, of course, giraffes, with fleshy pads for additional balance. It's like elephants. Rotosaurus browni was a sauropod dinosaur, like the Protosaurus. You know, the long legs. It walked with 4 legs and had long necks and tails. They were the largest land animals ever known to exist, and the group includes Diplodocus, which is the Brontosaurus. Andreas Jonas, the University of Queensland in Australia, and his colleagues analysed the foot fossils of R. browni to see how it could have supported itself. They found that the bone structures meant that it would have been able to have touched the heels on the ground without breaking its ankles. This suggests that despite being enormous, T. browni may have walked on its tiptoes. Footprints of sauropods that lived a few million years later have suggested that feet of the giants would have resembled those of modern elephants. X-rays of elephants revealed that the animals stand on their toes too and have thick layers. You don't need an X-ray for it. You can see it, don't you? A thick layer of sausages that touch the ground. R. browni was 5 times as heavy as an elephant, so it may have needed a similar soft pad to support its humongous body and give its balance, says Jarnell. However, there is no direct fossil evidence of such a heel on the R. browni or other sauropods, perhaps because the soft tissues really survived decomposition. Sauropods were much larger than their ancestors and have appeared to have evolved their hair relatively rapidly. As a result, not every part of their body was prepared for such an expansion, says Denver Fowler of the Dixon Museum Center in North Dakota. To adapt, sauropods would have had to evolve new weight support systems. A heel pads would have been useful, he says.
It's interesting how the Earth's choosing to get up.
Interstellar rock could have hit Earth in 2014. I think there's only one interstellar rock that we've seen coming through. Oh, yes, it's a... An interstellar asteroid may not have been the first interstellar rock to have detected. The meteor that burned up in Earth's atmosphere in 2014 could have come from a distant planetary system, and if it did, it probably from the area around the systems of stars where life would most likely to occur. Every day, more than 100 tons of space dust and rock hits our atmosphere. Most of it burns up before it reaches the ground. Earth is just sweeping up all the material like the front of a car's windshield that goes around the sun. Oh, damn. Okay. Oh, as it goes around the sun. Sorry. Says Michelle Bannister, Queen's University, Belfast, UK. Quote, this is, there is this regular pitter-patter, and you actually get this on the moon and other things, this pitter-patter. Most of the material comes from comet, asteroids, and planets within our solar system, but Amy and Avi Loeb at the Harvard University said that they have found a signal of a meteorite that traveled from further away. They came through the catalogue of meteorites spotted by a network of detectors owned by the US government to examine the object's speed and trajectories. They were looking for a meteorite that might have been gravitationally bound to the sun, because it was going to arrive at a certain speed. I mean, they would have probably been tossed from somewhere else. Yeah, I think that has to be not could. Probably that has to be even from somewhere else. If they're not gravitationally bound in our Earth system, that means that they come from outside. This is similar to how Oumuamua, our solar system's first documented interstellar visitor, was detected in 2017. It was far from Earth, but as yet we showed it couldn't have come from inside our solar system. Sidge and Lobert found a meteor that was also seemed to be from somewhere else. It was about 50 centimetres across and vaporised in an atmosphere in 2014. If we could study meteors like this as they burn up, we might be able to tell, this is interesting, like flame testing, that they made and learned other stellar systems. The meteor hit the atmosphere at about 45 kilometers per second. For it to have been bound to the solar system, it would have had to have been moving at 20 kilometers per second. This is far from the first claim of interstellar meteorites, said Bannister. Peter Brown, Western University, Canada, agrees. Today, pretty much all of them can be explained away with measured uncertainty, he says. To be able to say that we found the interstellar meteor, you have to know the uncertainty is very well. I don't think we can. In this case, the government database doesn't provide precise measurements and uncertainties. If the meteor truly was interstellar, its speed and trajectory indicate that it came from relatively close to another star in the Milky Way. If it were a dwarf star, this means the rock could once have been in the habitable zone. Where it is neither too hot nor too cold for liquid water life, which is necessary for life as we know it. Sarah and Loeb calculated that the objects roughly the size of this meteor could hit the Earth about once a decade, with larger rocks like Omnus being rarer. In 2014, a meteor was too small to carry life safely across the interstellar space from the home star. If radiation didn't prove fatal, being vaporized on arrival certainly would have. But larger, rarer objects may be able to spread life throughout the galaxy and even leave evidence of meteorites that make it to the surface of a planet. I think it's like looking for a message in Bahia Beach. Most of the time you see rocks, but once in a while you might find a bottle. That's a rather lovely way of putting it. It's interesting, Crick. I mean, it's hard to keep an open mind, but not be stupid. Okay. Question. Indonesia. Oh, it's got the Indonesian flag on. Satellites check for illegal fishing. Donnelly. Perched on the deck in front of me is a tiny satellite. Four black panels stick out like spokes of a windmill. Okay. Like a satellite, I would call it. Connected to spokes. Four. Yeah, I suppose windmills are four. Well, imagine maybe more. I suppose four would be a bit unstable, wouldn't it? Six, you'd have three. Okay. I suppose Dutch one's a four. It weighs less than 10 kilograms. It's suspended precariously on a metal rod. It's hard to believe the satellites this is hurtling around the Earth. This is a model as a life-size replica and technology firm Hilbert Nanosats satellites, which are already in orbit. Their job? To keep an eye on fishing boats for the Indonesian government. So far, the company has two satellites in orbit, but plans to launched another 20 to 12 in the next 18 months, my godfather. Satellites can receive information from remote parts of the world where getting your cell phone signals is nigh on impossible. You know, that would possibly be parts of Indonesia, but I doubt it. With each satellite orbiting the Earth at a speed of 7 kilometers per second, it's an orbital velocity, circling the planets 16 times a day, so it's low Earth orbit, extra satellites will be able to connect with anyone anywhere on Earth roughly once an hour. The Indonesian government is using Hilbert satellites to fight illegal fishing. What? Where boats catch fish in areas they aren't allowed to. Each boat in the trial carries a small modem and automatically connects to one of the satellites when it passes overhead, sending the boat's position and information provided by the crew to catch, even while still in the middle of the ocean. With our system on board small fishing vessels, the government can actually identify fish that have been caught, where and when by whom, says Cornell Jensen at Hilbert. This gives assurances for selling the catch. The fish cannot be illegally imported into the EU unless the country of origin is known, for example.
Sounds a bit weak to me.
Sorry, this is stroke thing where you just read and you just lose energy, but I'm pushing through. The technology is also being trialled by the British Arctic Survey to collect data from remote measurement stations. Previously had no satellite communication sensors, well, I suppose it's poles and stuff like that, especially if you're pole and under the, in the dark section. I just wanna, yeah, let's go really think.
Oh,
I think the problem with geostationary satellites, they're a lot further away and take a lot more power to get in. The inverse square law, things like that. Sensors are there, able to send their measurements once per day. Other companies are exploring similar technologies. For example, Spire Global, a network of 100 satellites, which will use by 180,000 ships daily to send information, including position and speed. This is used to avoid collisions and, or hopefully that's not, the information is used, but you wouldn't use it directly. We're going so fast. Okay, so we send it up. We're on collision course. Send it up to the light. Oh, yes, you are. Boom. It'll be all over you. Amazon and SpaceX have also ambitions to launch thousands of satellites to provide broadband internet access from space.
The number of data centers that
have spiked in the past 3 years, and they have become cheaper to build, says Andrew Fowler at the EMEA Satellite Operators Association in Belgium. However, the cost is still substantial. Hilbert pays about £50,000 per kilogram to launch another satellite. As the number of satellites in space increases, collisions and space junk are becoming more and more of a concern. Not if you're really small. The entire thing of narrow satellites, you're less likely to be hit. You have a huge blimp, you're going to be hit for sure. Hilbert expects satellites to burn up in Earth's atmosphere after 3 years of orbit, says Jansen. Expects it's modelled. 23 million girls are missing worldwide. A huge analysis, and this is by Deborah McKenzie, a huge analysis suggests sex-selective abortions may have led to 23 million fewer girls being born. Many societies value sons over daughters, as people around the world increasingly have fewer children. There has been a rise in families choosing to abort female fetuses in an effort to at least have one son.
Sounds bad to me. Normally 100 to 200 born to every 100 girls. Poor girls.
But this is, I suppose, you like the more slick, I believe, sex selection pressure on boys, I would expect. What is it, the acidity of the vagina determines where cells go out? But the analysis found the evidence that the unnatural excess of boys in 12 countries since the 1970s, when sex abortion started becoming available. Queen Koh, the National University of Singapore, and her colleagues synthesized the birth data from 70 to 2017.
From 202...
countries. I wonder how you get that one. Using modeling method that filled gaps in countries with poor statistics. Oh, yeah. During this time period, they found excess male births occurred in some years in Albania, Armenia, Azerbaijan, China, Georgia, Hong Kong, India, South Korea, Montenegro, Taiwan, Tunisia, and Vietnam. Alphabetical listing, is that it? Yeah. In every nation except Vietnam, the team found that the skew in sex ratios is returning to normal. This seems to be true in even China, which the analysis says accounts for 51% of the missing female births, maybe just by size. In 2015, 118 boys were born for every 100 girls, so that's significant. By 2017, this had dropped to 114. What's it supposed to get? Hello. Birth gender ratios have returned to normal in Georgia, South Korea, Hong Kong. But Koh's team found that four or six boys in Indian nation that the analysis suggests accounts for 46% of the missing girls is only sight. So that's half, that's almost India and China. Reducing the rate of sex selection in India is crucial for ending the practice worldwide, says Serbu George, Center for Women's Development Studies in New Delhi. I suppose that's one way of limiting the population, isn't it? Once you do that, you that's interesting in terms of this will be really interesting, the fertility rate, how that factors into it. Okay. Briefing by Claire Wilson. Reviving brains hours after death. The brains of pigs have been partly revived hours after death, but what does this mean for those of us with a human brain? Well, it's a pig's brain, so it's not your brain. What is the experiment? So we don't know who she's asking this of. Oh no, this is general. Brains were removed from pigs 4 hours after they had been decapitated and were then hooked up to an artificial supply of blood-like fluid for 6 hours. Surprisingly, this seemed to reduce the amount of brain cell damage that normally occurs after bodily death, and so seemed to be restored the brain cell's ability to perform some functions, such as using glucose and oxygen. Oh, well, that's, how alive is that? Did brains have been aware of what's happening? The fluid contained drugs that stopped nerve cells from firing to avoid any chance that brains experiencing some form of awareness. Even when some of the nerve cells were removed and tested in a dish without these drugs, they were found still to be capable of sending electrical signals. Does it mean we can bring dead people back to life? No, there's only limited size of individual brain cells functioning, not the coordinated activity of all brain cells, and structures need to achieve awareness. This is not a living brain, it's a cellularly active brain, says Nared Shadan of the Yale School of Medicine, who is part of the team that did the work. So you may not be an author. And it's hard to say that you only get that information deep into it. Oh God, I've got to go for an hour. How ethical is this experiment? Bloody ethical, I would expect. The researchers used pigs that had been killed for food, so caused no extra deaths, and they had approval from all the relevant ethic committees, so therefore it's ethics. But some US laws on animal research only concern work done on creatures still alive, so it's unclear how they apply to brains in this novel, partially revived state. team wants regulations reviewed. You can imagine that. Zombies. How does this change our understanding of the brain? Until now, we thought just a few minutes of oxygen deprivation would lead to brain damage, triggering a cascade of irreversible cell death and degradation. Now we know that at least some of our cell's activities can be restored even 4 hours after death. Without such special conditions like cooling and preventing damage, cell death happens across a longer time window than we thought. Could this affect organ donations after death? Not anytime soon. Donor organs usually come from someone who has had a severe brain injury and no longer has a functioning brain stem, a part of the brain that is essential for life. With existing technology, no one recovers after tests have shown brainstem death, says John Dark, Newcastle University. Are there any other implications? Oh dear. For a start, the experiment provides a new way to study brain death. And in medicine, the artificial blood substitute could be useful for helping protect the brains and other organs in the damage. This is artificial with the fake pig. Helping protect the brain and other organs after damage caused by lack of oxygen, as happens in after a heart attack. So I'm going to struggle on. Police use guns that bind suspects lean, so this is like it's these people that they used to use to catch people and sheep on the equipment planes. A gun that fires a cord tied, the assailant's limbs look like something straight out of comic books, but has made its way into the real world after the US police successfully used the device the first time. When the police at Fort Worth, Texas, what a great place Texas is, were called to deal with an armed suspect who had barricaded them inside a house, they turned to the gun called the Bowler Wrap. Tears, gas, forced the sweating into the open. But officers then fired. Sorry, a gun to make them escape. So it was attempting to remove the cord which was wrapped up around his leg. Officers overpowered him and took him into custody. The Bowler Wrap, which is a pistol size, has never been used. Okay. The Bowler Wrap is a pistol size with a laser pointer for aiming. It fires 2.5 metres along Kevlar cord up to 8 metres away, which wraps around the person, impeding movement. It typically is aimed at the person's leg. The cord has fish hooks like barbs, hello Rupee, at either end to attach to the clothing, secure it in place. The Bowler Wrap's name comes from weighted bowlers thrown by South American gauchos to capture cattle or birds. 16 police departments have been testing a device developed by the Las Vegas-based company Wrap Technologies, but this is the first time it's been used in action. Bowler Wrap is intended to prevent a situation from escalating. While tasers and pepper sprays inflict pain and may provoke violent remorse, Bowler Wrap simply holds the suspect in place. It's like handcuffs from a distance, he says. One of Wrap Technologies. However, there are potential hazards. Any device like this could be dangerous at extremely short range. There are concerns over the accuracy and risks posed by the head and neck, says Oliver Feely Sprague, a human rights charity, Amnesty International. Training will be important to use the device safely, says Mietrez. Okay, that's all I can read for. I've just reached 45 minutes. I'm not up to the standard. Sorry, guys.
Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.